Hello, everyone, and welcome to Science Spinning, the show that puts an Irish spin on science on 103.2 Dublin City FM with me, Sean Duke. On the show today, there's talk about a theoretical quantum computer. This is a computer that can harness the power of atoms that could make today's computers look a little bit like a child's abacus. We'll be talking to Michael McGettrick at the School of Mathematics in NUI Galway, who's going to be telling us more. In Inventive Minds, the slot where we talk to scientists that are commercialising their ideas, this week we'll be exploring Ireland's inventive minds of the future. Many of our future high-tech entrepreneurs will hopefully emerge from an innovation academy run jointly by UCD and TCD that was launched last week. I'll have in studio Academy co-director Susie Jarvis, who'll tell us about this exciting new venture. Now, Ireland, despite its current predicament, has many resources at its disposal. And in our final slot, we'll be discussing the Irish offshore and the potential for ocean energy that can be harnessed to produce electricity. And we'll be talking to Tony Lewis. He's of the Hydraulics and Maritime Research Centre, which is based in UCC. But now I have on the line Michael McGettrick, School of Mathematics, NUI Galway. Welcome to the programme, Michael.
Hello, Sean. Hello.
Yeah, welcome. So, quantum computing, I'm sure many of our listeners will have heard of quantum computing, but they might have absolutely no idea exactly what it's about. So maybe we could start by saying the computers that we operate today, how do they work and how are they different from a potential quantum computer?
Yeah, well, it's computers of today, I guess people use them day in, day out, and they don't kind of look at under the lid. But computers of today are kind of solid-state devices, so we talk about magnetic spins and silicon. You've heard of Silicon Valley and that.
Sure. But,
so silicon is the substance, and basically you have these things like magnetic spins that are on the silicon, and they all point in one direction. And if they point, say, up, that's a 1, and if they point down, then that's a 0. But the thing is about computers today is that there needs to be a lot of these spins, like of the order of 10,000 spins of these magnetic spins, to make one up. And then if there are 10,000 in the reverse direction, it's one down.
So if we were to try and simplify it, could we say that the language of the computer is just based on ones and zeros? And
a string of those? Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
But the thing is that miniaturization has got smaller, has made computers smaller and smaller, and because they're looking at these silicon devices at a smaller and smaller level, they're hitting what's called quantum physics, because when you examine individual particles or smaller particles, the laws of physics are different.
Okay. Now, so, quantum mechanics, again, this is a fundamental part of science. Really, you're looking at atomic particles, aren't you, and what happens at the very, very small level, so it can be quite odd.
Yes, quantum physics is a strange animal. It's essentially a theory which says that there is kind of, I would say, nothing deterministic about nature, in that in classical mechanics, if you hit a ball, it moves in a certain direction and we know where it goes.
Yeah.
But in quantum mechanics, when you poke an atom or something, it goes into some sort of state and it could go one direction or another, but it just all we can tell is that there's probabilities of it being in each direction or in each state.
So it could be, sorry to cut across you, but it could be in two different states, like let's say a positive and a negative state at the same time?
Absolutely, yes. This is the idea, yeah.
Right.
So a classical bit, you can't have this possibility. It's either one or zero. Whereas a quantum bit, essentially you can imagine it being three quarters, a quarter, or a half, or something like this, rather than zero and one. So it's some sort of mixture of the zero and one. And it goes into this state, and then when you actually measure it, you will still only measure either a zero or a one, but with different probabilities.
Okay, so it gives you more options in terms of calculating, is that it?
Yes, well, the power of it really is that because you have this intermediate states between the zero and the one, in fact you have an infinite number of these between any possible state between the zero and the one. If you put these together, you can build up, for example, for an input for a quantum computer, you can put the input data in with a small number of so-called quantum bits, they're called qubits, but you only need a few quantum bits to kind of represent very, very large numbers.
Okay. Now, I should ask you at this stage, how far are we down the road? I know that you're working in the general area. How far are we down the road to developing one of these quantum computers?
Well, we have them.
We have them. Okay.
Yes, I don't have one right with me here in the office, but we have them in Australia and in Austria. They have developed quantum computers using different technologies that basically have something like a few qubits. I couldn't say now whether it's one or two or three, but they have a handful of qubits that are that can do a calculation and that can do some of the standard so-called quantum algorithms.
And are they super, super quick?
These are super quick, but the problem is they're like the computers of, like our modern computers were invented in the 1960s, and they fill a full room, and because they only have a few qubits, they can still only add one and one and get two to some extent. They can't do too much. We need to have, you know, tens if not hundreds of qubits to actually do something efficiently, to do something well. So the engineering problem in actually controlling these qubits is enormous. The qubit itself is a very nice idea, but to actually control the quantum state at the particle level or the atomic level is an enormous engineering problem that basically over 10 years they are still grappling with. They have some success, but it requires very big machinery just to control one qubit.
Sure, and they do talk about other computers, future computers based on light and other things like that. So do you think the quantum computer will arrive before the others, or is it hard to say?
Well, you mentioned light, because a quantum computer, the one in Australia, is based on light. I mean, it's not, they use different, so they use lasers, essentially.
Oh, lasers, okay.
Yeah, so it is already, an optical computer,
yeah.
In the sense that it uses light, but it's using quantum physics, so there's an overlap between these different ideas. We're pretty sure that the quantum computer will arrive before. There's an idea of DNA computing, which I'm not that well up on, but the quantum computer, basically there are lots of people working on it, and we have quantum computers, as I say, and now it's just a question of miniaturization. Making them more efficient.
So if we get to the stage in the future where there's a lot of these quantum computers, how's it going to change things? How's it going to alter, you know, technology, society, etc.?
Well, there are two fundamental breakthroughs in quantum computing that quantum computing has done, and one is you're familiar with credit card encryption on the internet.
Sure,
when you type in your so this is based upon kind of very problem in mathematics with splitting up large numbers, but it has been shown that a quantum computer can split these large numbers very, very quickly. So if you had a quantum computer right now, all of that credit card encryption, all those credit card numbers could be broken in a half an hour or an hour. So that's something that will have to change, the actual whole area of cryptography.
So if you got a criminal who had a quantum computer and he was technically literate, he could crack the codes of the Visa cards?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Okay, well, we don't want that.
Yeah, so we don't want that. But we don't have a powerful enough quantum computer yet, but it will be here, say, in 10 years, people estimate, to do that. So we have to change cryptography. So that's kind of a negative thing in a way. But the other more powerful algorithm in quantum computing is for searching. And one of the most fundamental things you do in computer science is try to find something, like in Google or whatever. So if you search a list of objects, normally if you want to search through 100 objects and you've no other way of searching, you go one by one.
Yeah.
It takes you 100 checks. But if you do a quantum computer, one of the mysteries, one of the successful algorithms is that to search 100 objects, you only have to make 10 checks. To search the 100 objects. Now, it's quite the mathematics is a little bit complicated, but basically it's the square root of the number. So for 100 objects, the square root of 100 is 10, and for any number of objects, so the amount of checks you have to make is 10, which is an enormous improvement. So if we want to... So basically search engines should be even much more efficient than, say, Google, using quantum computers. But not just search engines, database access, all the standard things.
And video and all of those things. I mean, you know, your computer will just be able to work a lot more efficiently, a lot quicker.
Yeah. Well, there is another whole area which I should mention, which is not computing as such, which is quantum communication. So when you pass information across the telephone line, it's encrypted. But if you pass it using quantum computing, you pass it using a qubit, and nobody can interfere with a quantum state without it being detected. It's one of the principles of physics.
Okay.
If anybody touches that quantum state, it will change and it can be detected.
If you observe it.
Somebody observes it or somehow taps into it.
That's a strange thing, isn't it? Just by looking at it, you can...
You change the state. So at a fundamental physics level, you couldn't interfere with quantum states if cryptography is done this way. And there are already successful companies, again in Austria, that sell software. In fact, there's a line between two banks in Austria, as far as I'm aware of, about 50 kilometers, where they use quantum communication to make sure the communication is secure.
Okay, and will it be a long time before we actually see them in widespread use?
I honestly think so, because the theoretical work is all done, and the low-level quantum bits have been created, but it's really an engineering problem, it seems to me, with actually making this room full of gadgets, if you want, that they have as a quantum computer, shrinking that down to something like a desktop or a wristwatch. I mean, with classical computing, that took 10 years, 15 years, so it probably will be the same with quantum computing.
Okay, well, listen, thanks very much for coming on and giving us that overview, and we may talk to you again should some progress be made. Anything else, sorry?
Certainly. You're very, very welcome. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Sean. Thank
no
you.
Problem. That's Michael McGettrick, School of Mathematics at NUI Galway. He was telling us about quantum computing. Now, I'm glad to welcome to the studio Susie Jarvis. Susie is the co-director of the Innovation Academy, which is a new initiative which was launched late last week by TCD and UCD. This this hopefully is going to generate the next generation of Irish high-tech entrepreneurs. So welcome to studio, Susie.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Okay. Now, this is something new, really, isn't it? I mean, this is this kind of approach where, just to summarise, you get PhDs from arts and science together. You get them to interact creatively and hopefully to generate innovative ideas and companies ultimately. That kind of approach hasn't been done here before.
No, it hasn't, as far as we know.
Okay. So why did UCD and TCD decide that this was something that was worthwhile to do at this point?
Well, in part it was in recognition for the fact that only about 10% of our PhDs typically go on into tenured academic positions. So we recognised that we had 90% of our PhDs who really needed to find some added value in their PhD other than a standard kind of tenure track.
Okay, so a lot of people listening might not realise that PhDs now, there's actually a taught part to the PhD. So, you know, it used to be just at undergraduate level in university, but now there's a taught part. But there's also modules like, you know, innovation and entrepreneurship. That's all becoming part of the new way PhDs are taught.
That's right. It used to be that a PhD was basically a research activity that you took pretty much in isolation. It was just between you and your supervisor. So the supervisor would often define the project and you would work on that project in isolation for 3 or 4 years. And now we're trying to bring in more structure to the PhD where there are additional opportunities for learning things other than the basic research project during the course of the PhD.
Sure, and that means when they go to get a job, or okay, if they start up their own company, fine, but if they go to get a job, they're more marketable because they have these other skills as well as just their research. Okay, so one of the goals I read about of the Academy is to realise Ireland's ambition to create a smart economy. We've heard a lot about it. I presume this means a high-tech economy. So how can it contribute to that process?
Well, our programmes are designed to help translate ideas into value, very simply, and particularly ideas which have been generated during the course of a PhD. And often when you have a new idea, it's very difficult for you to implement that idea or grow that idea in isolation. You often have to bring in people with different skill sets. So it may be that it's a scientist who has a brilliant idea, but they need to bring in people from the business school, for example, to really develop that idea into a new company.
Sure.
So what the Academy does is it brings together people with these different skill sets and creates a situation where serendipity can basically help people come up with developing their new ideas, bringing in resources and skills outside their immediate domain.
So if you were a PhD, say, in a particular department, say physics or an old physics department, and you've decided to join the Academy, then you might meet, say, a historian from another university or somebody who's in archaeology or biology or whatever. So it kind of broadens your horizons in that sense.
That's right, and it helps you see opportunities that you might not have noticed if you were only sitting in your own school or department talking with other physicists. If you start talking to people from different disciplines, then you start to see how your ideas can add value to their disciplines, and you can start to see new opportunities arising.
So there's a big communication element, obviously.
Exactly.
Now, obviously, in the States, this kind of approach, obviously, it's different in the Irish context, but this kind of approach has been done in the States in Stanford, I believe.
Well, actually, we haven't seen anything with the same breadth of disciplines involved. There's a program at MIT called the iTeams program, but that's specifically where they link up technical students with business students. This goes a little bit beyond that, and it also brings in arts and humanities into the mix, and law, and, you know, additional things beyond the MIT program. And we think that new opportunities will come specifically out of mixing the broader range of disciplines.
Well, that's great. So this is the first time where it's really been expanded out to include, you know, virtually cross campus. Anybody really that's doing a PhD of any sort could sign up.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Now, there have been an initial round of students that have gone through, and from varied backgrounds, I believe. So how have they found it? It's a lot different from their comfort zone, if you like, their normal comfort zone where they do their own thing.
That's right. And we have deliberately given them challenges that push them outside their comfort zone. And in general, they responded to that very positively. But I think I would like to comment a little bit more on that, because this is really a challenge for the academy, in that universities normally have a very specific focus on helping students pass exams.
Yeah.
And the students recognise that they have to pass an exam, and they have a good idea of how they're going to be assessed.
Sure.
Whereas with the academy, we're trying to prepare them for something beyond the university environment. We're trying to prepare them for a work environment, whether they're self-employed or they're employed in a bigger organisation. And of course, some of our students are very young, and
yeah,
they've never experienced a work environment. So we're trying to prepare them for something that they don't really know anything about. And it can be quite difficult for them to sometimes recognise the value of some of the things that we're trying to teach them. So, I mean, you can imagine, if you've never worked, it's very hard to imagine what kind of skills you might need to instigate change in a multinational company.
Sure. I mean, you know, we've more experience, so we kind of know what's involved. But,
yeah,
you know, they haven't been working typically.
Yeah. I mean, I think, in addition to the student feedback, some of the feedback that we've had from other people about the academy has also been very worthwhile. For example, we were based in Foster Place, which is
in the heart of Dublin,
yeah,
there near
right.
Trinity.
That's mm-hmm. right. And we had an attendant sitting at the back of the room. So this is the guy who looks after that space and makes sure that the chairs are set out properly and things like that at the beginning of the day. And he sits in a little booth at the back of the room and basically reads for most of the day and watches,
sure,
and makes sure the building's okay. And I think at the beginning of the week, he was quite skeptical about some of the things that we were doing, because they seemed so different from what he normally sees going on in the building. But then more and more during the week, he started to get more and more interested, and he started standing at the back of the room and calling me over and saying, "These are fantastic ideas. The students are coming up with fantastic ideas." And he got really kind of caught up in everything that we were doing. And that was really nice, because to me, he represented a kind of typical member of the general public,
yeah,
if you like, who wouldn't normally be so caught up or involved in the academic programs. But for him to really feel that he was part of it and he was interested in it was great to watch. And I also saw him standing outside sometimes telling other people about what was happening in the building, mm-hmm, with a real sense of pride.
Mm.
And that was wonderful to see that happen.
And you're unlocking people's creativity. Like, they're quite bright, a lot of them, obviously. Mm. But, you know, they're being put into a situation where they have to think on their feet, come up with new ideas, etc. And enjoyment, I suppose, is a big,
yeah,
part of it.
Yeah, and another piece of feedback that was very positive, I thought, was at the launch, we showed a video of some of the activities that the students had been doing. Mm. We had them on a day on creative design. We had them out pushing pushchairs around the town and then coming back and redesigning the pushchair.
Not easy pushing pushchairs.
No. And we had different challenges. We had a seed funding challenge where they had to go and try and make money or add value to a very small amount of seed funding, €5 in fact. And at the end of the video, Barry Smith, who's the co-founder of Changing Worlds, he's a very successful,
yeah, a successful company
academic
at UCD, yeah,
entrepreneur, came up and he said, "Are we thinking of running anything for staff?" Because having watched the video, he really wanted to be in the room and he really wanted to be doing some of the things that we'd had the students
doing. Well, sure, it's something. I mean, obviously at the higher level, the senior staff level, they need to be talking to each other as well and getting ideas and going across the university maybe and meeting people that, you know, that sounds like a very good idea too.
Yeah, it was a fantastic idea, and I think it's something that the academy would certainly love to try to do, to offer to staff as well.
Okay, now obviously this is a project that's not going to, you know, start producing entrepreneurs tomorrow. This is a long-term thing, isn't it?
That's right, yes. So many of our students are actually in their first year.
Mm.
So they have another 3 or possibly 4 years of their PhD to complete before they're going to be going out and putting any of these ideas into practice.
And are you happy with how it's gone so far? I know it's new territory for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's always challenging, and anybody who's ever started a new venture knows how challenging it can be. I mean, we're in the same position as most people setting up a new venture, in that we have a lot of new ideas and no money.
Mm.
So we're trying to do what we can, and it's been very exciting so far, and I think we've made real progress.
Okay, and just finally, Susie, for anybody doing a PhD in TCD or UCD, it's just those two Dublin universities, they can look up your website if they're interested in finding out more or signing up.
Yeah, we've just launched a new website. It's innovationacademy.ie, so you can go and find more details on there. Or we're also looking for mentors from the public and private sector. So the students in their multidisciplinary teams go out and address problems in the public and private sector along with a mentor. So if people want to be involved, yeah, if they're listening and want to be involved as a mentor from the public or private sector, then please also go to our website and there's more information.
Okay, that sounds great. So anybody that's interested, either mentoring or students, then you can go to that website. And thanks very much, Susie, for coming in and telling us all about the Innovation Academy, which is a new venture launched. It's for PhDs by TCD and UCD last week. Thanks very much, Susie.
Thank you.
Okay, now we're going to just change the topic and we're going to talk about another way that might help Ireland get out of its current difficulties. We were taught, some of us, that we don't have very many natural resources in Ireland, but certainly there are the one big resource that we have is our offshore area, which is about roughly 10 times the size of the land area. And that, of course, contains water, which can be generated into electrical power. And to talk about this subject, I'm going to have on the line now, I've Tony Lewis. He's from University College Cork, and he's worked in this particular area. So welcome to the programme, Tony.
Hi there, Sean. How are you?
Not too bad at all.
Good.
Now, obviously, this is an area that we really need to be looking at, isn't it? Because we could certainly harness, just from looking at your website, we could harness quite a lot of electricity from the ocean.
Well, very much so. I mean, anybody who's been down to the beach on the west coast will appreciate the amount of energy that's available in the waves coming into the coastline there. And they roll in there all the time, and they're bringing the energy, if you like, from the whole of the Atlantic Ocean. The waves gather wind energy, they're generated by the wind, and they bring that energy from the whole of the ocean to our coastline. And then if you can devise the machinery to convert that, we have a huge potential to make electricity.
Yeah, and I mean, Ireland does. I mean, this is a great resource that we have. There's not every country that has that amount of wave energy just sitting there waiting to be tapped.
No, there are waves obviously around many coastlines in the world, but the large resources are in the sort of 50 to 60 degrees north and south, and that really means that you're talking about maybe northwest US, Western Ireland, South Africa, and Chile, and maybe even some parts of South Australia. So very few places in the world that have the level of resource that we have here in Ireland.
Okay. Now, what have we been doing to try and tap this? I know that your centre down there has been working on this for many years, but how far have we got thus far?
Well, we certainly have the test tanks here in the centre, the Hydraulics and Maritime Research Centre in University College Cork. Mm-hmm. We have test tanks here where we carry out model testing for these types of devices. And more recently, the government has really put into place a strategy for developing an industry which can harness this resource. And that then gives funding for people to come and use our facilities as the first stage of development. They've then set up the what's called the quarter-scale test site in Galway Bay, which is an intermediate step then going to the open ocean. Mm-hmm. And companies then can test at a limited scale, but still in the sea and having real problems at quarter-scale. And then the next stage would be to go out into the open ocean.
Okay. And do you have a lot of companies that are interested in doing that, taking that route?
Well, certainly. I mean, that is the route we've been pushing for a long time, which is a sensible development route. There are two Irish companies which are at the forefront of this development.
Okay, tell us their names.
They're called Ocean Energy Limited from Cove in, mm-hmm. in County Cork, and the other group is called Wave Bob Limited, and they're based in Maynooth in County Kildare there.
Yeah.
And both of those companies have been using our test tank facilities, and then they both have tested in Galway Bay, and both of these now are ready to go to the open sea to test their devices at the megawatt scale.
Okay, now before we talk about those two guys, how much, it's hard to estimate, I'm sure, but how much energy can we potentially harness from the ocean, from waves?
Well, I mean, the value of the resource on the west coast of Ireland is several times more than our existing electricity capacity.
Okay, so sorry to cut across, but yeah. Could we, I mean, theoretically, we could supply all our electricity from wave power, could we?
You could supply all of the electricity from wave power, but obviously the issue is that wave power, like wind energy and solar energy, is a variable resource.
Mm.
So it's not the same every day. And the real problem is that even though wave energy is predictable, if you had 100% wave energy, then some days there would be zero. So obviously then you have to have some way to store things, and that's not so easy.
Mm.
But the best estimate is that we could get up as far as 40% of our electricity capacity without any storage. So we certainly could do that. And obviously the advantage of that is that it's here, we're not burning gas, which comes from Russia, and we have control over the thing.
And at the moment, we haven't got to the stage where we're harnessing anything, is that it?
We're not at the stage where we're harnessing anything, but nobody else in the world is either.
Okay.
So that's
amazing, really, isn't it?
But it's a big engineering challenge. I'm sure many of your listeners that have been down to the seaside when you're in a full-blown storm. And the engineering challenge of building something to resist that storm is quite high.
So can you tell us, Tony, I mean, to try, in simple enough terms, if you can, what's involved with trying to harness that, you know, I'm thinking of the waves crashing onto the cliffs of Moher. How do you get that into electricity?
Well, I mean, you've got to try and be somewhere where you're not quite at the crashing level.
Further out to sea.
A little bit out to sea, maybe a mile or so offshore, even 3 or 4 miles offshore.
Okay.
And in that case, then, you'd have many types of machines, and that's one of the issues. There's no single machine which is the best option. But a typical machine, the Ocean Energy Buoy, is a very simple device. It's like a barge, which has an opening. The opening then connects to an air chamber. The waves compress the air in the air chamber, and the air is blown through a turbine to generate electricity.
Mm.
That's a fairly simple device, just with the air turbine out of the water generating electricity. The wave bob idea is that you have two floats, one which is on the surface, one which is under the surface, and these two floats move up and down relative to each other, and then by using hydraulic pumps, they pump oil in a generator circuit to make electricity.
Okay, I get you. And I'm sure there's other ways that you can do it too.
Exactly, yes.
In general terms, then, this is something we really should be going for in Ireland, isn't it? Because apart from the environmental benefits, there's cost implications. I'm sure, you know, if we could provide 40% of our electricity from this source, we're going to cut down our energy costs, aren't we?
We're going to cut down the energy costs hugely. And as I say, the security of supply is a much bigger issue. It means we have control over it, and we're not dependent on the pipeline from Russia. But the bigger option is, as I said to you before, there are no other countries in the world which have devices which are fully operational or commercial. So there is a business opportunity, an industrial opportunity. And, we missed the wind option. Denmark grabbed the wind option. They have an industry built around the wind.
So we need to get this. Sorry, Tony, I'm just running out of time.
Sorry,
but we certainly need to be, pushing this wave option. And I presume people that are, maybe listening could contact you at the Hydraulics and Maritime Research Centre at UCC, yeah?
Very much so. And the minister just published 2 weeks ago a vision plan to 2050. Where he sees this, and he believes there could be up to 70,000 jobs created if we follow this path.
Okay, Tony, thanks a million for coming on and telling us all about that. That's Tony Lewis. He was telling us about the potential for wave energy here in Ireland. Now, that's all we have time for this week, folks. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to contact me here at the show, my email is sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. And just before I go, I'd like to mention also our magazine, which is now available free online at sciencespin.com. Okay, thanks a lot and talk to you next week.